I feel like Heathers gets this more than most movies. The first time you saw it, it disturbed you, it freaked you out, you didn't enjoy it, it was not a pleasant experience. But then when you see it again, it's like, oh my God, it's a masterpiece. Then Richard Curtis wrote Notting Hill. Nobody comes up to him and says, first time I saw Notting Hill, man, it f***ed me up. But now, the second time, I realized it's so great. I remember the first day of shooting, the cast and crew hadn't met me yet. And I show up with like a black crucifix on my head. And they're like, oh, I knew this movie was written by some Manson fucker.
A lot of what's interesting visually in the movie was in Dan's script. He wrote a very cinematic script. You get a writer like Dan who writes brilliant dialogue and also is capable of walking out on you right in the middle of talking. I've never made a better movie than Heathers. It's a work that still resonates after all this time. Nobody ever thought that this little teen movie we were making would be anything more than a bit of a splash. I didn't really think that it would have the kind of life it's had.
Hey everyone, I'm Billy and welcome back to Half the Picture. I'm so excited to say that today we have two amazing guests for you, director Michael Lehman and writer Dan Waters, the guys behind the amazing cult classic film Heathers, which I'm sure many of you have seen, and if you haven't, you should definitely check it out. Now, this episode is one from our vaults. I recorded it a while back with Michael and Dan, and you'll be able to tell because I haven't got my Velasquez goatee in this one, as friend of the podcast Peter Capaldi described it.
You look like a Velasquez character, a Spanish painter. Often painted members of the courts of King Philip, whatever is the fifth of Spain. And they were often men like you with a mop of hair like that and a goatee.
It was so much fun chatting to Michael and Dan all about making Heathers and what it was like working with Winona Ryder and Christian Slater on the movie. I think you're going to love it. By the way, remember to like and subscribe to the podcast as it really helps us get more amazing guests on the show. So without further ado, let's roll on my conversation with Michael Lehman and Dan Waters. Enjoy. Director Michael Lehman and writer Daniel Waters discussing Heathers. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hey, pleasure to have you guys here. So just to kick right off, I thought I'd start with you, Dan. So you're a writer who has worked over your career in so many different genres. I mean, and you've written so much. I mean, just to name a few, you know, Demolition Man, science fiction. You wrote Batman Returns for Tim Burton. You know, of course, you directed your own material later on. And I suppose I just want to start off with asking you what.
So many genres. Is there anything you can do?
This is the question, Matt. This is the question. What sort of inspired you way back here at the start of your career to sort of go back to school, in a sense, and write a teen movie? What sort of, having so much versatility, why did you choose to do a teen movie, a high school movie, like Heathers?
Well, I was very young and naive. I can recommend Naivete too much, because Naivete is great, because if I would have thought a dark high school comedy that had that kind of language, that kind of attitude could get made, I'd be an idiot. I wouldn't have done it. But the fact that I was an idiot actually has helped me do it. I have the basic principle. It's you know, if the movies were better, I would have been a male Pauline Kael. I would have been a film critic. If like the movies were as good as they were in the 70s, I would have been happy to just watch movies and write about them. But in the 80s, I started to get bored. And basically, we had these things called newspapers. And when I looked at a newspaper, I would say, well, what's not playing? What movie do I want to see that's not playing? And I wanted to see a Doctor Strange Love with teen comedy. So I wanted to see a movie that was something different than John Hughes movies, which I thought were perfectly fine, but I wanted something different. I had came to the sad conclusion that I guess I'm going to have to write it. So I was working in a video store long before Tarantino, by the way. I was working in a video store, and so video stores are great because you're surrounded by movies, and it's not a taxing job on your brain, so you can kind of work out ideas as you're checking out movies. Things called video cassettes back then. And I'm sure Michael has heard this story 1,000 times that he chokes on him, is that, you know, my goal was, speaking of working in multiple genres, my ultimate goal was to have Stanley Kubrick direct a teen film. He had done a horror film. He'd done a couple war movies. He had done a period film. He had done a science fiction film, a couple science fiction films. Of course, the next genre he wanted to work in was the teen genre. Of course, that was no problem. So I was going to mail this off to the New Yorker in England. And it was going to be, I have the right to make a 3-hour script because Big Stan's going to direct it. Overnight, I went from Kubrick to Lehman. I use that as a punchline. But there's no way Stanley would have got my sense of humor the way Michael does.
You know, do we know if he was ever actually sent the script?
He was not sent the script. I think Winona told him about it directly, though.
Really?
They had a phone meeting about it, but way after the fact.
Later. Yeah.
Way after the fact. Also, I was at a rap party with Winona for one of my unheralded directorial debuts, and it was like 5 in the morning, and she called J.D. Salinger and had us all shout hello to him. So she had some pretty crazy phone calls.
Wow. I know Kubrick was in the 80s. He had his assistants like constantly searching for scripts. And I know that even like one of his assistants got the script for The Killing Fields, Bruce Robinson, and read it and was like, no, that pass on this. This is definitely not, you know. And then that obviously went on to get Oscar nominated. So you never know. It could have been in the mix, you know, potentially.
I had sat down with Todd Field once. Todd Field just says he got a call 3 a.m. from Kubrick telling him how much he'd loved him in Gross Anatomy. And like, he's like, Stanley Kubrick watched Gross Anatomy, which is a medical comedy with Matthew Modine and Todd Field way back in the day. And Jamie Gertz, I believe, was in it too. So Kubrick does get around. Mm. But back to Layman.
That's Layman, yes. Yeah. So, Michael, I was wanting to jump over to you now and ask a bit about your the early stage of your career as well, because I know that you famously worked for Zoetrope under Francis Ford Coppola back in the early 80s. He was producing things like, you know, One from the Heart and The Outsiders around that time. Which we were chatting before we started recording, you had done some work on, you were managing the post-production and the electronic cinema divisions. I'm just super curious to ask you about that time, because I remember when Godard passed a couple of months ago, you said on Twitter that, you know, he had an office on Zoetrope, Michael Powell had an office, David Lynch had an office, like all these sort of filmmakers were mulling around. And I just wanted to ask you what it was like to work there at that time when all that was going on, and what kind of stories you had.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was an extraordinary place because Francis had this vision of creating an old-time Hollywood studio like they had in the 30s with contract players and people who were employees who'd work on everything and had done a great creative atmosphere, unlike the Hollywood studios in the 30s. So he put together, he bought what was then called Hollywood General Studios, which is a small studio lot. You can see it featured in The Player in the beginning. That's where they shot that. And he took it over and brought in filmmakers from all over the world to have offices and be part of this sort of Zoetrope thing. So Michael Powell had an office. David Lynch had an office there. Mel Brooks had an office on the lot. Brooks Soames had been there. George Burns had an office on the lot. He'd been there for many years. I would watch George Burns drive onto the lot every morning in a huge Cadillac. You could see just the top portion of his head above the bottom of the windshield because he was so short. And you'd see this big car drive in the top of a head and some cigar smoke, and you'd park and get out, and this little guy walked to his office. He was very old at that time. So Mel Brooks, George Burns, Michael Mann had his office for Thief. So he was there. He used to drive his Ferrari into my parking spot and get really pissed off if anybody was in his spot even by an inch or so. This was an early Michael Mann. Nobody really knew who he was at that point. Frank Rodham had an office there. Martha Coolidge had an office there. Trying to think who else. And on the lot at that time, they were shooting things like Breathless, Jim McBride's remake of Breathless. Godard was there, and he camped out in an office in the back. And he shot some stuff on the stage with Storaro during the making of One from the Heart. He took over the stage for the weekend, and he hired me and my buddies who were working in this video division to use Francis's equipment. It was a wild place. It was a lot of stuff going on. Very cool. So I worked there. I started at the bottom and worked my way up about two rungs of the ladder, not very high up. But I worked there for three years and met a lot of nice people, a lot of good people who went on to do good work.
Amazing. So when you came to film school, then you were kind of the hot shot, this guy, you know, the guy had worked with Coppola and at Zoetrope. So that must have been, you know, pretty cool coming in and then all, you know, everyone being like, oh, who's this guy, you know?
Well, I had come to speak at a screening of One from the Heart because Francis said, oh, I want to send all the different editorial people there. So he sent Rudy Fair, who's one of the editors, old time Hollywood editor, had edited Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder. He was cutting on the show. Anne Garceau, who was the more contemporary editor, was cutting on the show. A guy named Randy Roberts. So he had the editors come and had me come to speak to the students at SC. And I had applied to USC and they lost my application. And I think I mentioned this, the screening. I said, you guys, you know, while you guys are here studying, I was off working on this really cool film because the school lost my application. And then eventually they found it and said, do you want to come? And at that point, his company was kind of falling apart. And I said, I'm going to go make some movies. And I went to Tennessee.
Bracket. So how did you guys actually first meet? Because I know you'd written Heather's Dan while you were at the video store. Michael, you had made The Beaver Gets a Boner, which had gotten a lot of notice. So how did you guys first actually like come together and be like, right, okay, you two guys are the ones who are going to make Heather's?
Well, I didn't go to UFC. I went to McGill University in Montreal, but I came out to LA to meet my best friend from high school who went to USC, Larry Karaszewski, who's a writer himself, wrote Ed Wood and People vs. Larry Flint and People vs. O.J. Simpson and People vs. Andy Kaufman. But so basically I moved in with these five USC guys and I was inundated with USC-ness. And they all did something, whether it was hold the boom mic or edit or shoot Beaver Gets a Boner, which is the student film directed by Michael Lehman. But Michael Lehman himself was an enigmatic figure in the background. You know, people starting out, I'm always like, I don't know how to get your script to an agent, but have friends who like your script. If you can get one person other than yourself to like your script, amazing things can happen. And so they all like my script. They like the 300-page Dawn of the Dead of high school films. They gave it to their agents, if they had agents, and they gave it to the only director they know, Michael Lehman. First agent I met with after Heather's basically said, oh, you've got some talent, you spooky little boy. We're going to put this Heather script in a drawer and we'll never talk about it. But you and I know you're talented. So now we'll have you do share. But then another agent who happened to be Michael Lehman's agent said, wait a second, this is great. Why can't we tell the world about it? And so Bobby Thompson, from there, she kind of connected with not only Michael, another path to Michael Lehman, but also to Denise Novi, who was ultimately the producer of the project.
You know, Larry Karaszewski figures large in all this because Larry was a student at SC. He's a great writer. He's a great guy. He's a big film fan like Dan. He helped put together the crew for The Beaver Gets a Boner because he was actually the person who directed me towards the script in the first place. He said, hey, you got to read this script. This guy, Redbeard Simmons, wrote it. And he's in the writing program. And I said, oh, Redbeard, yeah, I don't know who that is. And he introduced me. He was also a great guy. And Larry put together pretty much all the people who worked on the crew of that movie. And I tried to get Larry to edit it. And the school wouldn't allow him because he was a critical studies student, not an editing student. And at the last minute, they pulled the rug out from under that. I still feel terrible about this. But Larry, who is very good at putting people together, was the one who called me and said, you know, Dan Waters, he wrote this script. It's amazing. You got to read it. He needs an agent. Can you show it to your agent? And I said, well, why don't you show it to your agent? Because Larry and Scott, his partner, had done very well coming out of school and they had a big agent. And I think that's the one, Dan, is that?
Yeah, well, that way it was your agent who said, let's put it in the drawer. It'll be our little secret.
Yeah. Bobby Thompson was a very interesting young agent at William Morris. She represented Tim Burton. She represented Jim Cameron. She represented Joe Minion, right? The writer who wrote After Hours.
Everybody Corky's first agent.
Right, first agent. And Michael Tolkien, I think, was her client as well. She didn't keep all these clients for a long time, but through no fault of her own. Anyway, Bobby had seen Beaver Gets a Boner and I signed with her. When I sent her the script to Heather, she just flipped out. She got it completely. She loved it and she worked hard to put it together. Denise was a friend of mine. Did you know that, Dan?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I knew her through other people, but she was also a client of Bobby's. And so we got together on that. And Denise was obviously huge in putting the movie together.
It happened very fast. I mean, of course, me with visions of Kubrick in my head, like everybody who read the script around in our circle said, oh, God, this is amazing. Oh, dude, this is so great. And then Michael calls me up and just like, page three, I have some thoughts. Like, and he's giving me good notes, but like, who the fuck is this guy? Like,
I gave you some really bad notes too. Yeah, I remember going, this is too long and you'll never get anybody to read this like that. I mean, I, and there was a lot, honestly.
I need that voice.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I thought it was an amazing strip, but I was trying to help you get
Ben Hedren. Michael doesn't lead with the compliments. When we got to the set, I realized he liked the script.
That's ridiculous.
I'm sure you're used to this, Michael. I'm sure you're used to this. It's interesting you bring up people like Karaszewski and Denis Dermy, because that's what I wanted to ask you about next, is because when I look back at Heathers, and not just Heathers, but that whole period of the late 80s and the early 90s, especially with relation to the stuff you guys were doing, I think about, you know, Tim Burton, Denis Dermy, Karaszewski, Alexander, that writing duo, and you guys, you're making these movies that are incredibly subversive, that are blackly comic, that often have a real sort of edge to them, and of these really fascinating sort of indie-spirited, independently-minded movies. And of course, I know, Dan, you shared a house with Larry and Scott, you know, back in the early days. And when you guys look back on that time, or at the time, did you feel like, oh, we're part of this sort of little gang of sort of kind of up-and-coming subversive filmmakers? I mean, I even think about like the Coen brothers and Barry Sonnenfeld, like those kind of guys, like that sort of subversive late 80s sort of thing. Did you guys think about that at the time?
I'd say absolutely not. I mean, especially in Scott and Larry. Scott and Larry, they're very different personalities. They're definitely an odd couple, like Felix Unger and Oscar Magnuson. No way you'll get that reference. But anyway, Scott's kind of persnickety, and Larry is everybody's best friend. But I was there on the ground floor for their writing partnership, and they were sitting on a terrace at Silver Lake trying to write this script, and the rest of the roommates would crack up laughing, like, well, how do these guys seem to get along? This is the most disastrous relationship I've ever seen. Like, this makes Siskel and Ebert look like lovebirds. But like Siskel and Ebert, their all underwater approach worked. And like, now we're like, wait, the worst combination of two people is now one of the most successful writing teams. But we didn't see it.
They're still doing it, and they're still exactly the same. Their personalities haven't adapted or changed over the years. They still are the same two odd combined people.
Yeah, they no longer cringe at each other because they understand each other so well. So, oh, that Scott, oh, that Larry. But me, on the other hand, I knew I was going to be a god. I'm kidding.
Depp was destined for greatness. Everybody knew that.
At least it's for the mid-90s. Well, it's funny, looking back, I mean, you talk about me working in different genres. I perverted different genres. I never was faithful to a genre. And that's why people like you, there's a secret cult of people who get my work. But especially Batman fans, Batman Returns is not their favorite because it breaks all the rules. The rule-breaking genre movies take a while to get some love.
If they get love.
Mine eventually get love, but it takes a lot. Sometimes it eventually lasts 20 years.
So staying with that theme of, you know, you guys, there's that group of sort of filmmakers, you guys and Burton and Dermy and Karaszewski and Alexander, that those guys, you guys. Just thinking about Heathers as well, like jumping into like Heathers. Because you and Francis Kenny, Michael, shot Heathers in with wide angle lenses, 1.85:1. Like a lot of like, you know, like Burton's films at the time, like Beetlejuice and Batman and Ed Wood, and they were all shot in that with those wide angle lenses, where everything's distorted and heightened, and it's all, you know, exaggerated. That was a deliberate stylistic choice, or was that just purely practical? Like, okay, we've got to shoot it in just with those in that way.
I always felt like personally that the way what is considered a wide angle lens sees the world is much closer to the way we, or certainly myself, see the world. You know, we have a lot of peripheral vision, and we don't feel the distortion that happens when you get, you know, very close to a camera and it changes things. However, I like that look, and Kubrick and Polanski, they both kind of, you know, use those low angles, wide angle lenses quite a bit, and I like their filmmaking, and I feel like a regular, flat, longer lens, it's a boring look. It tends to beautify things. It's easier to shoot with, but there's nothing like a nice wide angle lens, and particularly, I think for me at that time, it was a big Kubrick influence because he used those a lot.
And so that was a conversation you had with Francis. It was like, okay, this is, I mean, everything is going to be heightened, and you know, it's not realism. It's, you know, it's, you know, pushing it more into.
It's a choice. I had that conversation with him, and we looked at. So when we were trying to break down how to shoot the whole high school cafeteria sequence, we looked at Full Metal Jacket, which I think was Kubrick's most recent movie, I think, at that time, and we sort of broke down
all the stuff in the barracks following the Marine drill sergeant around and that sort of thing. And I said, our movie, the scene isn't like that, but can we use some of these techniques? Can we use these lenses? Can we make it look like this sometimes? And that was a way of shooting. Didn't require a whole lot of discussion with Francis to try to figure out how to do it. But I definitely told him and Mitch Duvin, our camera operator, that those were the kind of frames that I wanted to work with. And they liked that.
Speaking of the cafeteria scene, I was going to ask about that because there's some really, watching the movie again, there's some really wonderful cuts in the film. And one of them that I particularly liked is there's the cut in the cafeteria scene where you have the two jocks and they're you know, talking about how much they'd like Veronica, you know, the Veronica have a sandwich. And then they do the fist bump. And then you cut to that slow motion tracking shot of Veronica handing the note to Heather, and everything is suddenly slow motion, and the music, David Newman's music, kicks in, and the pace changes. And I also think the cut later in the movie where you have Martha Dunstock in the gym, and she's you know, and you have the sound of that crowd around her, then you cut to a wide, and then she's alone. And this is a question for both of you: like, Dan, were those cuts, those beats, sort of in the script? Did you know when you were writing, okay, that beat is there, or was that in the editing room that you found those?
That was definitely with Michael and the late Norman Allen in the editing room, which was because my script version was the Godfather wedding scene. It was so much longer. So much was cut from that scene. And I think, you know, beautiful cuts, beautiful. It's funny. There's a lot of us that still remember lines in the script, like there, and think they were in the movie. Like there was this whole speech about toothpaste commercials and like you can't have ugly people in toothpaste commercials, as instead of Chandler talking, because you'd be stained with loserness. Like, wait, stained with loserness isn't in the movie anymore? Like, what? Like, a lot of people after the movie, it's like, where'd that go? Did you cut it since the movie was released? And like, no, it's all, yeah. I mean, Michael's gonna explain that process. I just want to point out one thing. I never saw a fist bump before that movie. I think I invented the fist bump because it was a conscious idea not to do a high five, so I had them punch fist. I haven't seen it before. Faulkner didn't invent it. I think I need some residuals on fist bump. But please, Mike, talk about the editing.
I think there's a fist bump in Pilgrim's Progress.
Damn you, Button.
Well played. Yeah. Well played,
sir. I can't be sure.
And I think Dickens had one in Bleak House. Punch it in. It's cool. You may be right, Dan. I don't remember any fist bumps before that. And but the guys did it, you know, as if that was what they always did. You know, a lot of what's interesting visually in the movie was in the script, in Dan's script. He wrote a very cinematic script. It's something that screenwriters should be aware of, is that when you get a writer like Dan who writes brilliant dialogue and also is capable of walking out on you right in the middle of talking. it's also important that the writer visualizes what is happening, because that's what you end up shooting, right? You know, and Dan's script was filled with that. I don't remember specifically things like going from the fist bump, the sound of the fist bump to, you know, the soundtrack changes and goes to slow motion. Those are the kind of things you play around with in the editing room that come up. Norm Holland, who edited the movie, was a terrific editor. He had a lot of good ideas. I thought the Martha dump truck in the gym thing, I thought you wrote that the sound of cheering was on and then it went out when we
yeah, I did do that. That was a change from, like, in the script, she's alone in a movie theater and she knocks over a Coke, which, if it's ever happened to you in real life, is the most, and you're alone in the movie theater and you knock over your Coke, it's secretly the most depressing thing that can ever happen to you. But we weren't going to get a whole movie theater to shoot one, that set, so we had to shoot in the gym. So yeah, that's when it fuzzed it up, yeah.
The whole business that Dan was talking about, though, about how we had this really long sequence in the cafeteria, and it had all sorts of great stuff. There was nothing that was off in the script in that regard. I mean, it was all, everything worked. And I think everything worked in the way we shot it. You know, the performances were fine. It looked good. But when we cut it all together, the first screening of the movie, and Dan, you were there the first time we screened the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. People have what it's called a friend screen. I call that one the fiend screening.
Yeah. Everybody came up to me afterwards and said, wow, Layman, that's great. You had a really good script and you fucked it up. I mean, these are my friends. They were all telling me this. And I said, no, you guys, you don't know.
because I had spent time in cutting rooms on movies. I said, movies take their shape as they get closer to length. There's a lot of stuff that improves from things that are taken out. Even if what you take out is really good, it has a life of its own and a rhythm of its own that's not the same as what was in the script quite often. And the movie got better by cutting out some of the things that were really terrifically written and really good. And I hate that we took out Stained with Loserness. That bugs me. I thought that was in the movie until just a few years ago. I was like, what? Did we really take that out?
The cut before that cut, which we just watched ourselves without music, I thought was brilliant. It was like a 3-hour Tarkovsky film, but it was so, so brutal. And it was just brutal and nasty, the come and see of high school movies. But then we cut it down a little bit more, and it was you know, it's always the second draft of the script. The second draft of the script is always the worst draft because you're trying to do notes, but you're trying to keep some stuff in. You haven't re-identified yourself. So it's like Michael said, you can't give rough cut notes at that young of an age, I think. What is it in the movie, fuckers?
So what are your memories exactly of the shoot? Because it was both your first movie, first feature. And I mean, speaking for myself, I mean, I worked on a friend of mine's film in an editorial capacity, and I was on set every day. It was a low budget horror film that actually has a lot. It takes a lot from Heavens, actually, coincidentally. But anyway, and I have such...
They all do.
They all, yeah. It goes without saying, doesn't it? But I have such distinct memories, vivid memories of basically every day of that shoot. I can remember what people were saying, what they were wearing, what was going on, what the vibe of the room was and the set. And as this was your guys' first film as well, even though it was 30 years ago, I mean, what are your memories? Are they particularly vivid of the shoot?
Dan was there every day. I believe you were there every single day. Am I right?
I wasn't there every single day. I still don't drive, and I live in LA. And some of the locations are a little far from me, but I was there most days with my little bus. I remember the first day of shooting was Ash Wednesday, and a lot of the cast and crew hadn't met me yet. And I show up with like a black crucifix on my head, and they're like, "Oh fuck, this movie's." I knew this movie was written by some Manson fucker. They're all a little. Get it out, but
that. Do you remember the first day was we were shooting croquet in the backyard of Veronica's house, and there was a huge windstorm, and it blew a bunch of our equipment away. There was equipment damage. We had to stop shooting.
Oh, I don't remember any. This.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was either the first or the second day. I think it was the first day though. I mean, I remember all the crises that came up, and no shoot is without its crises. But that was a very friendly group of people. You know, we got on well. It was a great crew, a lot of young people. Dan, I ran into John Hutman the other day. I was having coffee. He was sitting at a table next to me, and I was looking right at him, and I didn't recognize him. And somebody yelled at him from a car, "Hey, Hutman," something. It was on the street in Brentwood. And I said, "John Hutman?" And he turned and he looked at me, and we looked right at each other. And I said, "Do you know who I am?" And he took him about 10 seconds. He goes, "Ah, Michael." And it was really strange. He looks great. Anyway, John Hepman was about 25 years old. He was a production designer.
He went on to do those Nancy Meyer movies where they do those million-dollar kitchen scenes. Like,
yes, he's doing another one. He's in prep right now. He had a great art department, and they were very funny people. And the prop guy was really funny, and our camera crew was... it was great. I mean, our camera crew was...
I got a UPS delivery. Keep talking.
I'll keep talking. This is boring for you. Francis Kenney had worked with Ed Lockman, and he worked on a lot of good indie New York movies as an operator. Desperately Seeking Susan, that sort of thing, you know. And Mitch Dubin, our camera operator, had worked with me at Zoetrope. Mitch went on. He's Spielberg's camera operator. If you look at all of Spielberg's movies for the last 20 years, I think, Mitch is the camera operator. He does the most amazing shots anybody does, including, you know, Saving Private Ryan and all that stuff. So Mitch was the one who got me in touch with Francis. Mitch had also worked with Ed Lockman in New York. Mitch Amundson was one of our camera assistants. He's a big DP now. John Schwartzman was our...
He was the AC and he shot Transformers.
That's right. He's the DP on Transformers. And John Schwartzman... who does also tons of big movies like The Rock and but many more other big films, was second unit DP because he'd gone to film school with us.
Tell him about our stunt director.
Oh, Dan Bradley, our stunt coordinator, went on to become the second unit director on all the fucking big Bond movies.
Right? Is that? Is there anything else that you should know about Dan?
The whole crew is a Midas touch.
But and Denise DeNovi is a terrific producer, and she got together a lot of really good people, and she held everybody together well. So, you know, you think about that shoot, even though we didn't have much money and we didn't have a lot of time to do what we needed to do, we did have a really good group of people. So most of my memories are really fun. And Winona was fantastic. You know, she was so gung-ho to make that movie.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of wrote the characters almost like a female Travis Bickle, like all snark. And she really brought a humanity to it. And you could feel that every day. Like her freshness on the set was like, Jesus, maybe this is a more interesting character than I thought. Like, you know, she elevated everything. I think a lot of people have worked on other low budget pictures that have murders and have high school comedy to them, but they could tell this was a little different. So they felt like this was a little special.
Well, I was going to touch on that actually with, because I know the casting process was pretty lengthy and you guys auditioned a lot of people, especially, like, you know, teenagers, you know, who wanted to be accurate to the ages of the characters. And I know, like, Brad Pitt did a reading once for JD, and then, but then you obviously landed on Winona and Christine Slater. What were they like together and to work with?
They were good together. And Winona and Christian got along really well. Kim Walker, who plays Heather Chandler, was Christian's girlfriend at the time, but Winona and Christian always had a, you know, very good chemistry. They like each other a lot. He's an odd duck, and I never really could tell how much he understood the script and how much he got the nuance of what he was doing. He would always do it really well the way he did it. And he was very professional and very good to work with, but a little bit less outgoing, less extroverted than Winona. And then we had interesting chemistry between the three girls. And, you know, we auditioned a lot of people for the Heathers, and I think we ended up with good ones. But it was sort of a strange group, wouldn't you say, Dan?
Yeah, no, it's Shannon Doherty changes everything, because I had known her as this sweet girl from a NBC show. And whatever reputation Shannon Doherty has started on Heathers. And Michael can tell the story of Heather Graham, who gave a brilliant audition for Heather Chandler, but her parents thought I was Satan. So,
well, you did have the cross on your head. If you have the cross on your head at the time,
they never got to see that cross on your face. But Heather Graham came in and just knocked it out of the park. She was the perfect Heather Chandler. It was amazing. I mean, he just went, oh my God. And she was, she'd already done, didn't she do License to Drive before that? She'd been around.
Yeah, that's all she had done.
Yeah. And I wanted to cast her. And Dan, were you in the, you must have been there for that.
I was not in the room.
Oh, her parents wouldn't let her do the movie because she was only 16 or she was 17. And it wasn't, she needed their permission. Her father was an FBI agent. Her mother was a school teacher in Orange County, California, which at the time was a very conservative area. And I called the mother and I begged her. I begged her to let her daughter do this movie, and she was dead set against it. She could not believe the language and the script and the murders and all this stuff. And I tried to convince her that it had a moral center and that it really wasn't what she thought it was. And that, you know, yes, it was a stylized kind of language, but teenagers really do these sorts of things and really do think this way. And she did talk to me for over an hour. And then she said, no, I will not for you let my daughter do this. So the first thing Heather Graham did when she turned 18 was Drugstore Cowboy.
and then she's like, I don't think she would have done Boogie Nights unless it was to get back at her parents. Like,
yeah. Or Twin Peaks as well. I mean, Austin Powers, I mean, less said about, you know, that the best.
I worked with her many years later. She was on Californication. I maybe had met her once or twice in between, but I said, hey, do you remember that audition you did? And, you know, we had a fun time talking about that. She, you know,
I wasn't sure about well, my parents.
Tell me about that. I want to hear stories like that. That's,
I'm sorry. You never ask.
I'm supposed to ask.
Do you have any good Heather Graham stories? You should be asking me those sorts of things. she was lovely. She was great. And she had a big sense of humor about it. You know who else I worked with years later? Oh, I'm blanking on her name. The one, oh shit, there was, we got another really good reading on Heather Chandler from a young actress who was up for a Tom Cruise movie. Do you remember who this was?
Oh, no. I know you said Leslie Hope made a great read.
Yes, it was Leslie Hope. Leslie Hope came in and gave a read. You don't know who Leslie Hope is, right, Billy?
There's no way.
It rings the bell somewhere. Yeah. Like Google list is building. Yes, Karen.
She gave a terrific reading. And I think this was after we couldn't get Heather Graham. And the casting director said, well, you know, yeah, she's really good. She's so good that everybody wants to put her in everything. She's the hot young thing. She's up for whatever Tom Cruise movie was happening at that time. And she passed because her representative said they didn't want to be out of the running for this Tom Cruise part, which she never got. 25 years later, I'm shooting Tyrant, is an FX show that I was directing in Istanbul. And Leslie Hope, we cast her. And she's great. She's a really good actress. And I said, do you remember this? And she remembered as well. She goes, yeah, there were a lot of things I was supposed to, that were supposed to happen that didn't happen. She went on to have a very good career, but not as the, you know, Tom Cruise's leading lady.
I'm going to have to ask you about more of your stories you're holding back from me.
I got a lot of them, man.
So it's funny because you said, there was something that you said there that was particularly interesting, because you said, so the movie is obviously famous for being satirical and edgy and bloody, and it, you know, it sticks a dagger in teen movies. But there is this undercurrent of compassion to the film, which I hadn't noticed as much before, but on this watch I did. And it's interesting because you have these scenes between like Winona and Lizanne, you know, the scene in the bathroom where they sit down and Winona, you know, comforts her. And then you have the final scene, of course, which I know there were multiple endings in play at one point, but the ending that we got, which is Winona and Martha Dunstock, because as I say, the original ending was originally a lot darker, a lot more satirical. That sort of undercurrent of compassion and pathos, was that something that sort of was there from the start, or did that sort of develop as the movie developed?
Dan, I want to hear your answer to that.
No, if it was there from the start. Years after the movie has come out, I've grown accepting of it. I've grown to like the ending. I don't think it was that organic as I was forced to write. You know, I don't think a happy ending was organic at the time. To me, it played so happy that there's a wink to it. If you're a cynical asshole like me, you could still enjoy the ending. We had a lot of darker endings. But looking back on it, the way people respond to the movie now, I've learned to like the ending, even if it was cynically conceived to help to make placate fears that the studio was making it was having. Like the creators of the Heathers the musical, which is very popular in England right now, and I love the musical. I think it's a hoot. And the guys who wrote the musical said they wouldn't have written it if the movie didn't have a happy ending. It's like the happy ending kind of jarred them into thinking a musical is even possible. And so just so I have the musical and have this whole new injection of relevance into my life, I'm for the ending.
It's funny because Dan isn't, one of his main incredible talents as a writer is if he's given a note that even if he doesn't agree with it, but he can make some sense out of it, he can still write that note better than anybody else. Kicking and screaming, maybe, but he'll still do it. And we had a lot of issues about trying to get the ending right. Dan wrote that ending. And I always thought,
I'm a people pleaser.
Yeah, you're a people pleaser. But I thought, well, that's a pretty, you know, in a way that ending backs off from a lot of the stuff we were trying to do. But we had no choice. You know, we had to do, maybe come up with something that would make New World happier. They weren't going to make the movie. But the other thing that happened, and I think always is a good thing when it happens, is no matter how dark you make your material, if you find emotional inroads to the characters, it really helps make the movie more engaging, more interesting, regardless of how horrible people behave. If you believe that they think they're behaving in good faith and the actors playing it think that, it brings a certain level of emotional accessibility and humanity, even to the darkest stuff. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think you still go as dark as you want, but try to find those places where that makes sense for the characters. My concern about that ending wasn't so much that it was happy, because at that point, the movie had obviously played out all sorts of really dark things. I just didn't want it to be cute. And I remember thinking, having Martha circle her in the wheelchair, which either came about from just the actress playing around with that thing, trying to learn how to steer it, or I might have said to her, why don't you just try circling around? I was very on the fence about it. I thought it was possibly too cute, but we kept it in because it seemed to help what I think, Dan, you were talking about, that wink that says, yeah, here's your happy ending, motherfuckers. We're going to give it to you, but you don't have to really believe that that's what we wanted to give you.
Yeah, it has a fantasy element to it. Like, if we pulled out and it's like a crystal ball that the devil's holding, like, you believe there's, like, you know, that there's something cinematic about it that I like.
Well, I mean, I agree with what you said, Michael, in terms of, like, the fact that you do feel the character's pain and you do empathize, and you are that you're inroad into the movie, and what happens is Winona, of course, and the fact that you feel it, and it isn't just, you know, taking a step back and pointing and laughing at something, it's that as well, but you really feel the emotion heightens the darkness for me. Like, you know, like, it does heighten it. It doesn't detract from it.
Yeah, and everybody thinks the movie ended with the school blowing up or something, but the ending that we were working with at the time was the way JD comes out with the bomb. It's Winona, who character comes out the bomb, and she does a final narration on her back, and then she turns around, she's wearing the bomb, and says, boom. And then the movie ends. Now that I say it, I'm getting chills. It's so fucking good.
That was good. Yeah. Why didn't we do that?
But my Veronica Sawyer kind of needs to get blown up. Winona's Veronica Sawyer, hey, Jesus Christ, I just came out to see a movie. Why are you fucking me up so much? Like, it would be a little maybe weird for people.
I wanted to ask, going way back to when we talk about editing and rough cuts, Michael, of course, you know, you worked at Zoetrope, you were around all these filmmakers. When you were, and this is your debut, when you were cutting the movie together, when you were screening it and doing the rough cuts and the friends cuts and, you know, the fiend screenings, did you ever, like, ring up any of those guys from the old days from Zoetrope for advice, or did you bring them in to see your rough cuts? Did that ever happen?
I know that at that fiend screening, it wasn't Zoetrope, was Karen Murphy and Kiva were there. Is that right? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Man.
Karen, who produces all of Chris Guest's movies, you know, like Best in Show and all those sorts of things. She was a friend, and she'd worked on some really good films. And her husband, I guess, is an editor, Kiva Rosenfeld, who'd also went on to direct some stuff. Jerry Ross, who was our sound designer, was all a Zoetrope guy. He worked on Apocalypse. He was an old friend of mine. And so he provided a lot of help in that regard. But for the picture cutting, I don't think so. You know, I was scared to show it to people. And, you know, back then, it wasn't. Nowadays, you have a rough cut. You can just stream it to somebody. It's easy to show your rough cuts to people. Then it was on film. We didn't have the money to make video copies of these things. And you really couldn't send them out. So the only way to show it to people would have been to invite them to a screening. And we had only a couple of screenings during the cutting process.
I mean, it's such a hard movie to judge because it's a comedy, but it's not always a comedy. Like, when it's a pure comedy, just sit in the back of the theater and wait for the laughter or non-laughter. But like, some scenes, like, is it okay they're not laughing? I think it's okay they're not laughing. They're disturbed, right? At least we got something.
Yeah, I mean, generally, you when you do comedies, you screen them to see if the humor is working at all. Because that's always tricky. And you find something that you think is hilarious and that you was worked on the page and worked on the set and worked in the cutting room, and you screen it to an audience and there's no reaction. And then you have some stupid thing that you always thought was really awful, where somebody trips over and falls and that sort of thing. And you screen it and everybody's just uproariously laughing. You have to screen these things to figure out what's working and what's not.
I've always hated the line that I wrote, lick it up, baby, lick it up.
Jeez. That's a great line.
Even my shit doesn't smell like
So when you were sharing it then, that, what you just said there about how there were some things that you thought would be a dead cert, like that's going to kill it, and then there'll be just be crickets. And then there was something that you thought, oh, that's awful, and then it'd be like, it would bring the house down. Do you remember like a specific moment like that surprised you?
That we thought was going to kill and didn't kill?
Yeah. That there was nothing but crickets in that first screening. Later on, when we were doing the test screenings, and I believe at that point the movie was pretty much finished, we did marketing screenings. Those were really interesting because the audience reacted in a big way. They laughed at the funny stuff, and they went, oh, at all the things that were violent and unexpected. And then the numbers from the screening, you know, the surveys about how people felt were pretty low because they went, oh, we don't know what this is that we just saw. Is it supposed to be comedy? Is it supposed to be a horror film? What the fuck?
Yeah, it's so much fun. As you know, I don't care what it does to the cards, but when Heather Chandler drops that glass coffee table, it's like the whole audience is like, what kind of movie is this? Wait a minute. And Michael was already shooting his second movie when I was the only one of us at the first test screening. And it's funny, I was sitting next to a young woman who worked for the marketing company hosting the test screening. She was Miss Chatty Cathy beforehand. Like, oh, this must be so exciting, your first movie. Turned her after the movie is over, and she's just a dead sheet, and she thinks she's been sitting next to Jeffrey Dahmer all this time. And like, so stunned. And then years later, Memphis Film Festival, Michael and I were at it together. She now runs film festivals, and she comes up to me, and she says, I have to tell you a story. And she's like, the first time I saw Heather's, I was sitting next to you. And she tells the whole story. I go, oh my God, I know you told her what she was wearing at the time. And like, she's, oh my God, my God, I love Heather's. It's so great. I'm sorry. I can't believe I was so naive back then. But I thought that's the perfect reaction to me. It's like, I feel like Heather's gets this more than most movies, as far as like the first time you saw it. It disturbed you. It freaked you out. You didn't enjoy it. It was not a pleasant experience. But then over time, when you see it again, it's like, oh my God, it's a masterpiece or something like that.
That's pretty much it, Dan. Masterpiece.
It's pretty great. It's pretty good.
They appreciate it more. Like I joked with Michael before that Richard Curtis wrote Notting Hill. Nobody comes up to him and says, first time I saw Notting Hill, man, it fucked me up. But now, the second time, I realized it's so great.
I mean, it did kind of fuck me up, I will say, when I first watched it. But I think that's another story. So that's another Q&A. We'll do that another time. So when the movie first came out, after all those test screenings and the rough cuts, as you say, it wasn't a big, you know, it wasn't a big box office bonanza. And it took its time to really, you know, for it to snowball and really pick up the audience that it now has. And it was obviously, you know, in Europe, it was retitled Lethal Attraction, which is a totally bizarre move. Were you expecting any of that when you first came out? Or did, because I know that filmmakers, when they bring their movie,
the European trailers for Lethal Attraction is great. The first line is, it's always been a fantasy to me to be with two guys at once. Like,
what? Yeah, I saw that on the Blu-ray and I was like,
crazy. I know it didn't make a lot of money, but it was so well received and the right people got it. Like again, it's another one of my career destroying theories of like, hey, if 40% of the people hate your movie, then you're doing good. Like, you know, like these are wrong things to be thinking when you're trying to make a career. But the right 60% dug it and it got really interesting reviews. And so I was happy as a clam, even though I didn't make major box office. Because I knew my next film, The Adventures of Ford Fairlane with Andrew Dice Clay, would get me money.
How about you, Michael?
Well, you know, it was funny because I was very sensitive. It was my first movie. It was a big deal. I wanted everybody to love it. But then you make a movie like that and you know that everybody's not going to love it. And if everybody loved it, I'd hate myself because you want to make a movie that's going to stir the pot and get under the skin of certain people. So I guess I kind of understood that. We had some bad reviews and I can quote them all at length. And we had a lot of good reviews and I could not possibly recall those. Because you fixate on all the criticism. But really, for the most part, the fact that the movie had nicknamed...
Waters' dialogue is so arch, he could build a second high school on top of it.
Who said that?
Some fucker.
Yeah.
Just smile.
But as Dan said, a bunch of people who were significant as critics or people who talked about movies, that sort of thing, seemed to like the movie quite a bit. You know, we took it to the Sundance Festival and it was early days for Sundance. It didn't quite mean what it came to mean later to be at Sundance, but it was sort of the beginning.
It was the year that it turned into Sundance, though. It's like it wasn't called Sundance, it was called the US Film Festival, but we were with Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Miracle Mile and a lot of great films. Everybody loves Sex, Lies, and Videotape, but our movie was like, a lot of people thought we were doing it. How dare, this is not an independent film.
this doesn't belong in a festival. People came up to me and I learned that things like somebody would come up and smile and shake your hand and go, yeah, yeah, it was all up there on the screen. You know, boy, fuck you. You know, that.
Yeah, done.
I get a lot of that.
Well, I mean, Sex Lies and Videotape is on Criterion, but you guys are on Arrow. I mean, and that's the true test of, you know, cool. You know, yeah. Although Criterion are cool. I love Criterion as well. But, you know, Arrow.
Cool. We should be on there. I don't know why, you know.
The Criterion, are you calling? Oh, no. Yeah, no.
Get out and up now. We want, yeah. 4K remaster. So obviously, even though it had that slow start, the movie over the last 35 years has really, you know, is picked up and has really took on a life of its own and it lives. And
I think 35 years.
Okay, well, not quite 33. And it has taken on a life of its own, and it does. I mean, like I say, it's great talking to you guys who made this, because, you know, I'm a teen movie. You know, those movies kind of got me into movies, and the fact that, you know, you guys made, for me, you know, one of the most important ones. I think it is. You know, it's great. And I think,
can I say, give some advice to writers out there, if you want for longevity, make sure your costumes can be Halloween costumes forever.
It really helps your longevity. So
I've seen it. It's true. I've seen it with Heathers. It's definitely true.
Fort Fairlane, a lot of Fort Fairlane costumes out there.
So obviously the movie has influenced so many other, not just teen movies, but movies in general, but specifically teen movies. You have like Assassination Nation and I mean the movie I worked on, and like, you know, all these movies that have taken something from it. And then obviously the one everyone always brings up is Mean Girls, which I know your brother Mark Dan directed. And I'm just curious.
Hawk him. He's dead.
I was thinking, like, should I bring this up? Yeah, fuck it. I'm just gonna Did Mark ever talk to you guys, seeing as he is family? Did he ever talk to either of you about when he was making Mean Girls? Like, oh, this is, how did you do that in Heathers? Or like, did he ever talk to you about it when he's making that film?
I mean, it's kind of like the way Eskimos have 50 different words for snow. You know, it's always been the belief that there can be different kinds of teen movies that are small. Like he knows that Heathers is haute couture and he's ready to wear. Like, he's the Gap. But Everybody Loves Mean Girls is a terrific comedy. It's a great comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Mark's a terrific director. He was a film student when we were making Heathers. Was he at AFI at that time or a little after?
Little after, and like, he had to use my money to be go to film school. I paid for him to go to AFI, and what did it do to me? Stabs him in the back.
Yeah. But you know, Mark is really good, and Mark is a more gentle and more friendly filmmaker, I think, than, you know, his sensibilities are more that way than Dan's. Dan, you must have talked to Mark about this stuff when he was doing Mean Girls, or was he just apologetic that he was
kind of saying? Well, my favorite story is when we happened to be working on a project together at Paramount, and we went. And this is just when Mean Girls was about to be released. And we went in Sherry Lansing's office. And Sherry Lansing just goes, there's never been a movie like Mean Girls. I mean, there's been bitches in high school, but there's never been three bitches. And me and my brother and I just like biting our lips from laughing. Like, like, it was just so insane. Like, obviously, they're very similar. But, you know, like I said, it's there's room for both of us. And there's already good, like, 15 years between Heathers and Mean Girls, so.
Did you know, Dan, that they offered me Mean Girls before they took it to Mark? Did I ever tell you that?
No.
Yeah. I got the call.
Now, that would have been embarrassing for you to take.
Yeah. Well, I got the call, and I remember I read the script. I said, I made this movie. You know, I can't do this.
It was
with a really good script, but.
I went into a live first reading of the script, and I walk in the room, and Tina Fey goes, oh, mate, offer. Covering her face, which I thought was a delightful compliment.
But, you know, Mean Girls is a really good movie. I got no complaints about it.
Yes, 95%. We're 60%ers. My brother's a 95%er. Who wants a universal adulation? Fuck that. I was traumatized by Mean Girls. No, you weren't.
Moving swiftly on then. Okay. So, like, I'll know not to bring that up next time. But sticking with that theme, it's been now 30 years plus since the movie came out, and it's done so much and it's influenced so much, the musical, the TV show, all this stuff. And you've got, like, you know, nerds like me talking to you about it. How do you guys feel about the movie with all of that, you know, baggage, I suppose, all these years later? Like, how does it resonate for you?
Well, I went through a period of like, oh my God, why haven't I written anything as good as Heathers? now I'm now in my older years, I'm like, hey, at least I wrote Heathers. That's something. I can die happy.
Ah, that's a hook. Come on.
I'll put Heathers in my tombstone. That's not going to be I'll take in the grave with me. But it's definitely getting more compliments now for Hudson Hawk, because that thing is just, I don't know what, it's got a bad shit renaissance.
Yeah, we didn't get many compliments at the time. But, you know, Dan, it's not as if you only wrote one good script. It's always been odd for me because I'd never made a better movie than Heathers, for sure. I mean, it's clear. And so I say, well, that was my first movie. Shouldn't they all be better afterwards? But what you learn is, and I'm very happy with a lot of my work, but the thing that happens is when you get something like Heathers, that the combination of elements just happens to come together better than would be expected. And it's a work that still resonates after all this time. That's pretty unusual. So like Dan said, I'll take that. That's incredible. Nobody ever thought that this little teen movie we were making would be anything more than kind of a bit of a splash in the shock value humor world at the time. I didn't really think that it would have the kind of life it's had. And partly the life it's had, unfortunately, is because there's been steady waves of violence in American high schools, which is something that didn't exist at the time, you know?
Yes, I prefer the musical to Columbine as far as keeping me in the news cycle.
Exactly.
But totally, because I mean, over here in Britain, watching the film, it's obviously in some ways quite different, because in Britain, obviously, gun laws, you know, that kind of thing really doesn't happen as much over here. But watching it, and I didn't watch it as a teenager, I watched it when I was a bit older, but it does still have that impact. That thing of just being in school and being 16 and just rolling your eyes at absolutely everything, and seeing, growing up sort of surrounded by people who had that sort of spirit, which is the thing that sort of resonates most for me, like in terms of my own, you know, adolescence, as just as a kid in England growing up, was just that spirit is everywhere, I feel, even over here. And it definitely still resonates, you know, on that level, and many others. We've rattled through all my questions, and this has been, you know, so much fun, guys. I mean, this is actually, I've done a few of these Q&As, and this is actually the most, I think this is the most fun. I've just been great listening to you guys, you know, banter.
Yeah, I hear your Richard Curtis one sucked, so.
like I could get Richard Curtis. I mean, so yesterday, Richard Curtis.
Yeah, but Dan was like a lawyer.
Yeah. Just been, can't get Richard Curtis.
I mean, I'd rather be chatting to you than Richard Curtis. I know you guys, obviously, you know, you've made, you know, stuff together, and your careers have been so varied. But and you're practitioners of film, and I know Michael's all, you've directed TV, and I know you're also fans, that you're great fans of film, and you've talked about the influences on Heathers and your other films. And sticking with teen movies, in the last sort of 5 or 10 years, or even, you know, in recent years, have you seen sort of many youth films or teen movies that you've enjoyed and that have kind of, you feel like, got something right about adolescence? Because I know Heathers, one of the original intentions was to like shine a light on the stuff that hadn't been shown in sort of teen movies up to that point. Have you seen any sort of movies that have done that since?
You know, what's annoying is that, I mean, there's surely there's been some fine teen films on, but like I feel like even movies about adults are like high school movies now. It's like all the same kind of bickering and bitching. I feel like we don't have enough adult movies anymore. Everything seems like a high school movie. Even movies that take place in an office, they feel like high school movies now. So I'm a little sick of that. There's a movie that nobody's heard of. I recommend it to your people. Detention. Look it up. It's a wild. It's trying to outdo Heathers, and it's crazy. But I think it's hilarious, and it's the greatest ode to teen films I've seen recently. I'd recommend it to people.
Mm. Billy, you should know that Dan sees every movie. He sees virtually every movie that hits a theater anywhere in the world every year, and he publishes a list at the end of the year of his rankings. And always, if you ever want to know whether a movie's worth seeing or not, just get in touch with Dan and ask him. He will have seen it, and he'll tell you.
Are you guys not part of the Letterboxd craze? Are you sort of following on with that?
Yeah, I can't. If I step into Letterboxd, I'll never leave. It's like, have this bucket of heroin. Go to it. I can tiptoe over Twitter and Facebook, but Letterboxd, I'm just afraid it's going to be quicksand for me.
It is brutal. It is a problem. I'm not going to lie. And there's a whole sort of, I think there's a whole generation of us who have kind of succumbed to its charms. But, you know, we're working it out. We're working out a deal. Thanks so much for talking to me, guys. This has been so much fun. I just, as I say, I am like a big Hudson Hawk fan. And there is something that I've wanted to ask you guys, because I know that production was chaos and it was, you know, I know of the things I've read about it. I've you know, researched it. I have a strange, perverse fascination with that film. And I genuinely think it is one of the funniest films I've... I mean, I put it this way. I first watched that because me and my friend were like, oh, these are the guys who did Heathers. Let's watch this. And I know Mark Mode is a critic over here, who's a big fan of it. So we stuck it on. And it honestly took us about 3 hours to get through the movie. And the movie is 90 minutes, but it took us 3 hours because we kept pausing it at every 30 seconds because we were laughing so hard. It took us... an afternoon.
3 hours to go because I have to lay down and my chest pains died down.
I had to finish vomiting.
Trauma's the premiere night audience not laughing.
Oh my God, that was a little...
Is this an audience or an individual painting?
Well, all I'll say is that like they were wrong. It's amazing. That movie got me through some hard times.
Tragedy plus time equals comedy.
People were primed to hate that movie when it came out for various things that had really nothing to do with what we were doing. They were primed to hate it, and they did. So anyway, go back to what you didn't say.
Were you going to say something, Dan?
No, I was going to say spam.
Well, okay. So the line, there's so many lines in that film, but the one that always, that probably, it took us about an hour to recover from it.
The line I'm thinking of, Bruce wrote of it.
It's something to do. It's one of these. It's a particular convention to do with one of these. That's the line. The hat convention in July.
A hat convention in July, and you had to add a July to it, which makes it even weirder. I love that line.
Oh my God!
It's not mine. Was that Bruce's or yours or what?
I don't remember how we came to that line.
Well, the way Bruce delivers it makes me think it was his, because let's say we'll be seeing you at that hat convention in July.
Yeah, busy. So odd, I can't remember. I may have had something to do with that.
Okay, baby's your concern. Ooh. Although it is your kind of sense of humor, too.
Yeah. I think it may have been a discussion about, is there something that can be said here that would be, yeah. But
okay, you're right. I can see you. If it came out of discussion, I can see that totally being here. Yeah. But see, getting, well, that means you can't go to a hat convention. When will this hat convention take place? August is 2 weeks for hat convention.
No, you're ahead. That hat convention in October doesn't sound as good.
These are all the questions that are running through our heads as we walk. It took us about an hour to get over this one.
These are a summer thing, aren't they?
When are most hat convention? We didn't have the internet then. We couldn't just look on our phones and go, best time for a hat convention. The world has changed so much.
The other line, and actually, I think we talked maybe a little bit about this, Michael, when we were messaging, but after you did the intro for us. But like, so I've got the novelization of Hudson Hawk over there on my
set. Fuck that novelization.
I
wanted to see how the screenplay ended. And maybe this is the castle blew up.
Oh my God! So I've literally got the book, the hat. I've got the poster. I've got an original poster of this movie, Daniel. I've got an original UK quarterbiss. There it is. Literally.
Oh my God! It's a novelization because it is lazier than the script. I wanted to, you know, the castle blowing up, and then the castle blew up. Like, you motherfucker!
I don't know how many times have you read this, Dan.
I skimmed it.
What? But this is the thing. So I've read this book. I've read this front to back. And so the production was chaotic, and like Bruce was throwing out lines like about hat conventions, July, left, right, and stuff. Like, you know, there was an energy to it. But if you read this, the Butterfingers line of, you know, that, so we're in Rome, they're in the car, they're outside. Andy and Bruce are up there. And
this is my anything you do a rape joke, that's me. I'm sorry. You can't get me canceled. Don't get me canceled. But
this is getting cut out. But like the red, when he says, "Do you want me to rape him?" Which it took about half an hour to get over that line. We watched that. Okay, that's got to be improv. But then like I was reading the book, and in the book. So was that line scripted?
that line perfectly like captures the Dan Waters tone of what having your silly, stupid character say rape out of context is just. And by the way, when I see the movie again, I always forget about that line, and I always gasp and throw on my shoulder, patting myself on the back. It's such a shocker. I mean, it was Bruce's idea.
But was that
so dryly that, I mean, it worked,
he was
right?
He was great. I mean, Tim and Chris Levinson probably hate me for helping him to get cast in Batman Returns as Christopher Walken's son. But he's great in Hudson Hawk.
So that line was actually in the script. You wrote that. That was in the script. That made
that was
it.
That was first draft gold.
And the fact that it's in the novel as well gives me a lot of. It brings me some strange joy. It brings me some strange joy that it's in. That's so what that was copyrighted. That was bound, printed.
Can't do that anymore. Can't make jokes about rape.
I mean, times change. Times change.
Different world.
Hey, say hello to Chris Levinson for me, dude.
Yeah, no, likewise. Big fan. Big fan. Ed Wood as well. You know, big fan of that.
Be happy to hear that.
Tell him I wrote a novel that you won't finish.
You wrote an excellent novel that I won't finish.
You always give it to Chris? Wait, you've written a novel, Dan. Is this brand new? Is this brand new information, or is this something that has been around for a while?
Well, I'm still doing some last minute editing, but it's if you like it, want me to rape him, you're going to love this work.
Can I get an advanced copy, please? So I can to go for and pick out all the...
I'll fly a helicopter over your house and give it to the whole neighborhood.
I mean, I could talk about Heathers and like all the stuff you guys have done together, especially this and Heathers for hours, but in all seriousness. But genuinely, like, thank you guys so much for talking to me. It was such a pleasure. And like I said, this is the most fun I've had doing one of these so far. So thank you. And thanks again for the work you guys have done. It really means a lot to me.
Billy, thank you.
It's been fun.
Stroking our egos. All right.
This is what I'm here for.